This is Lecture 8 in the cycle Human Values in Education by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Art and Language in Education, July 24, 1924. You can see by now that anthroposophic education truly values the fact that teachers must consciously know the whole human being. Various examples have shown that the typical worldview today is not at all capable of a deep understanding of the human being. Let me clarify what I mean. When we study the human being, we distinguish between the various constituent members. First, there is the physical body. Then we come to the finer ether body or life body, which includes the formative forces of growth and the processes of nourishment, and which, during the early years of childhood, are transformed into the forces of memory. Then we add something that plants do not possess, though they, too, contain forces of growth and nourishment, and even memory, insofar as they maintain and repeat their forms. The next member is one that human beings have in common with animals, the sentient body or astral body, which is the bearer of sensations. Added to this is the capital I organization. These four members must be distinguished, and to the degree that we do this, we can truly understand the human being and human evolution. To begin with, our initial physical body, so to speak, arises from our heredity. This is prepared for us by our fathers and mothers. During the first 7 years of life, that physical body is cast off. But during this time, it is the model used by the ether body to build the second body. Today, people tend to oversimplify everything. If a boy of 10 has a nose like his father's, people will say it is inherited. But it is not that simple. As a matter of fact, the nose is inherited, but only before the change of teeth. And if the ether body is strong enough to reject the model of the inherited nose, then it will change during the first 7 years. On the other hand, if the ether body is weak, it will not be able to free itself from the model, and at the age of 10 the shape of the nose will still be the same. Externally, it seems as though heredity might still play the same role in the second 7-year period that it did during the first 7 years. Here, people are likely to say that the truth must surely be simple. In reality, matters are more complicated. Today's views are mostly the result of laziness rather than an urgent desire for the truth. It is therefore very important that we learn to look with understanding at the body of formative forces, or ether body, which during the first 7 years gradually creates the second physical body, which in turn also lasts about 7 years. The ether body, therefore, creates form, or sculpts. Now a true sculptor works independently and has no need for a model, whereas a poor sculptor makes everything according to a model. Likewise, during the first period of life and working toward the second, the ether body fashions the human being's second physical body. Today's intellectual climate enables us to gain knowledge of the physical body. It serves this purpose well, and those who lack intellect cannot gain such knowledge. But our universities cannot go beyond this. The ether body cannot be understood intellectually, but only through the imagery of intuitive perception. It would have great significance if teachers could come to understand the ether body. One should not use the excuse that teachers cannot all be expected to develop clairvoyance to describe the ether body. But teachers could practice sculpture instead of studying the usual university courses. Those who truly work at sculpture and go into its formative qualities learn to experience the inner structure of forms, especially the kinds of forms that the human body of formative forces also work on. Those who have a healthy sense of form experience the sculptural element only in the realm of animals and human beings, not those of the plant world. Just imagine a sculptor who wants to portray plants through sculpture. It would make you angry enough to strike such a person. A plant has a physical and an ether body which make it complete. Animals, on the other hand, envelop an ether body with the astral body, and this is even more true of human beings. This is why we can begin to understand the human ether body by working as sculptors and entering the inner structure of natural forms. This, too, is why modeling should assume an important place in the teacher's college curriculum, because it provides a way for teachers to understand the body of formative forces. It is a fundamental principle that if teachers have not studied modeling, they cannot truly understand child development. The art of education based on knowing the human being brings a heavy responsibility because it points to such facts and brings with it corresponding requirements. It can also cause apprehension because it seems as though you have to become extremely critical, rejecting every common practice. Just as the ether body works to free itself and become independent at the change of teeth, so the astral body works toward independence at puberty. While ether body is a sculptor, the astral body is a musician. Its structure is of the very essence of music. All that arises from the human astral body and becomes form is purely musical in nature. Those who can grasp this notion know that to understand the human being, another level of training is required to become receptive to an inner musical worldview. Those who are not naturally musical cannot understand anything about the formation of the human astral body because it is made of music. Thus, if we study the ancient periods of culture that were established on an inner musical intuition, and if we enter the Eastern periods of culture in which even language was imbued with music, then we find a musical view of the world even in their architectural forms. Later in Greece this changed, and now especially in the West it has changed radically. We have entered an age in which technology and mathematics are emphasized. At the Gyrtianum in Dornach we attempted to go backward in this sense. Musicians have sensed the music behind the forms of the Gyrtianum, but in general this is poorly understood today. Therefore we need to gain a concrete understanding of the human being and gain the capacity to grasp the fact that the human physiological and anatomical form is a musical creation, insofar as it arises from the astral body. Look at the intimate connection between the musical element and the processes of breathing and blood circulation. Human beings are musical instruments in the sense of breath and blood circulation. Consider the relationship between breathing and blood circulation. With 18 breaths per minute and 72 heartbeats per minute, we get a ratio of 4:1. Naturally, this varies in many ways, but by and large, you find that the human being has an inner musical structure. The ratio of 4:1 has an inner rhythmic relationship itself and expresses something that impinges on and affects the whole organization in which human beings live and experience their own being. In ancient times, the meter of verses was established according to the breath and the metrical foot of the circulation. Dactylus, dactylus, Caesar, dactylus, dactylus. 4:1, the line expressive of the human being. But what we express in language, footnote, the metrical foot, in quotes, in the classical languages, was based on the length of time taken to pronounce the syllables, categorized as long or short. The foot is often compared to a musical measure, the long and short syllables to whole and half notes. In English poetry, feet are determined by emphasis rather than length, with stressed and unstressed syllables serving the same function as long and short syllables in classical meter. A dactyl is a stressed syllable followed by two unstressed syllables. For example, Canada, holiday, camouflage. The term comes from the Greek for finger, and one can remember the pattern by thinking of the three joints in a finger, long, short, short. End of footnote. But what we express in language is expressed even earlier in this form. If you understand the human being from a musical perspective, you know that tones function within us. On our backs, where the shoulder blades meet, and from there carried into our whole being, forming and shaping us, are the human forms constituted from the fundamental note of the scale. The form of the upper arm corresponds with the second, and the lower arm with the third. And because there is a major and minor third, not a major and minor second, we have only one bone in the upper arm, but two in the lower arm, the radius and the ulna. These correspond to the major and minor third. We are formed according to the notes of the musical scale, the intervals hidden within us. If you study the human being only in an external way, you cannot understand that the human form is made up of musical notes. With the hand, then, we have the fourth and fifth. In our experience of free movement, we go right out of ourselves, taking hold, as it were, of outer nature. This is the source of the feeling we have in response to the sixth and seventh, a feeling that is enhanced by experiencing eurythmy movements. Keep in mind that the use of the third appeared relatively late in the development of music. The experience of the third is inner. With the third, we realize an inner relationship with ourselves. When humankind lived in the seventh, however, people mostly experienced going out into the world outside themselves. The experience of surrender to the outer world lives with special strength in the seventh. Just as we experience the inherent nature of music, so the forms of the human body are shaped from music. Thus, if teachers want to teach music well, they must make a point of getting children to sing from the very beginning of their years at school. This must be done because the very act of singing induces freedom. The astral body already sang and released the forms of the human body, and between the change of teeth and puberty, the astral body frees itself. Out of the very essence of music, the forms that free human beings begin to emerge. No wonder, then, that when music teachers understand that we are thoroughly imbued with music, they naturally allow this knowledge to enrich their singing and instrumental music lessons. This is why we not only introduce singing as early as possible into our education, but we also allow children with the right aptitude to learn musical instruments so that they can actually begin to grasp the musical element that lives in their human form as it emancipates itself. None of this can be approached in the right way unless teachers have the right feeling for it. It ought to be clear that every teacher training college should be constituted so that its curriculum runs parallel to university-level medical studies. The first approach leads to the kind of intellectual understanding that comes from studying anatomy. This should lead on to an artistic understanding of form, and this cannot be acquired unless, along with the study of physical anatomy, students practice modeling. Again, this should lead to an understanding of music. True knowledge of the human being cannot be attained unless medical studies are supplemented by an understanding of the role music plays in the world. During college training, student teachers should gain an understanding of music, not just externally, but also inwardly, so that their inner perception sees music everywhere. Music is indeed everywhere in the world. One simply has to find it. And if you want to understand I-being, you must master and make the inner nature and structure of some language your own. We understand the physical body through the intellect, the ether body through an understanding of form, the astral body through an understanding of music, and I-being, capital I-being, through a deep and penetrating understanding of language. This is exactly where we are greatly lacking today, for there is much we do not know. Consider the German language, for example. In German, this object that rests quietly on top of the body, round with eyes and nose in the front, is called Kopf. But in Italian, it is called Testa. A dictionary tells us that the translation of Kopf is Testa, but this is purely external and superficial. It's not even true. It is true, however, that if you have a feeling for the vowels and consonants in Kopf, you will experience the O as a definite form that could be drawn, as eurythmists know, as the rounded form to the front that becomes the nose and mouth. And if we can allow ourselves to experience it, this combination of sounds reveals everything that is given in the form of the head. So if we want to express that form, we use the larynx and lungs and pronounce the sounds approximating to k-opf. We say that the head also contains something that enables us to speak to one another. We can share what we wish to make known, say, a will. If you want to describe the head not as round form, but as a vehicle for information that clearly defines what we wish to communicate, then the very nature of language gives you a means of doing so. When you say testa, you name what communicates. When you say Kopf, you name a rounded form. If Italians wanted to describe the round characteristic, they would have to say Kopf. Likewise, if Germans want to express the aspect of communication, they would have to say Testa. Both Italians and Germans, however, have grown accustomed to expressing something different in language, since it is impossible to express completely different things with a single word. Consequently, we are not saying exactly the same thing with the words Testa and Kopf. The languages are different because their words express different meanings. Now let us go into the way the members of a particular nation live with the language of their folk soul. The German way of living in language is formative. The German language is really one of sculptural contemplation. This happened in German because in the evolution of speech in Central Europe, the Greek element is retained. When you study Italian and the Romance languages in general, you find their configuration is such that they are developed out of the soul's motor function. They are not contemplative. Italian was formed from inner dancing or singing, from the soul's participation in the whole bodily organism. We can see how the eye is related to the essence of the folk soul. By studying the inner relationships and makeup of language, we learn how I-being functions. Teachers thus need to gain not only a feeling for music, but also an inner feeling of language, starting with the fact that modern languages have retained only the soul's feeling experiences in exclamations. For example, when we say etch in German, it's as though someone had slipped and fallen, and we want to express this along with the amusement it causes. With exclamations, language retains feeling. In other respects, language has become abstract. It hovers above things, no longer inside them. But language must again become living and real. We must learn to grapple with language. We must be able to experience I-being going right through the sounds. Then we can feel the difference between saying Kopf, which gives us an immediate feeling for drawing the head's form, or saying Testa, which gives us the feeling of wanting to dance. Teachers must develop articulately this sense for feeling one's way into life's activities. If teachers can become accustomed to viewing the physical and spirit together, for they are indeed one, as I have repeatedly said, and if they can continually increase their ability to do this, teachers will never be tempted to delve into intellectual abstractions, but endeavor to keep all education between the change of teeth and puberty within the realm of imagery. When you are accustomed to thinking pictorially about real things, there is nothing more distasteful than someone who talks intellectually and in a roundabout way. This becomes an unpleasant experience. When you are accustomed to seeing life as it actually happens, you wish to describe it only as it is, completely in the image of it. Say, for example, you want to reach an understanding with someone, but that person forms judgments purely on the basis of intellect, describing everything as beautiful or ugly or wonderful. Everything is one way or the other, and you feel in your soul as if your hair were being pulled out by the roots. This is especially unpleasant if you would really like to know what the other has experienced, but this individual really never describes it. For example, I might speak of someone I know who raises her knee very high when she walks, and this person immediately responds, quote, "She walks well," unquote, or, quote, "She has a good carriage," unquote. This tells us nothing about the woman, only about this person's ego. But this is not what we are after. We are looking for an objective description. This is very difficult for people today. People tend not to describe things, but the way things affect them as beautiful or ugly, and this gradually affects even the formation of language. Instead of describing the face itself, people will say something like, quote, "He sure looks terrible today," unquote. Awareness of such things should be part of the deepest training of teachers, to get rid of the self and to come to grips with reality. If you succeed in this, you will also be able to establish a real relationship with the children. Children feel, just as I have described, that their hair is being pulled out by the roots when teachers do not get to the point, but speak only about their own feelings. If you simply stick with what is concrete and real and describe it, children will quickly get into it. So it is very important for teachers not to overthink. I always feel it is a real problem when Waldorf teachers think too much, but it gives real satisfaction to see them develop a faculty for seeing even the smallest details and discovering their special qualities. If someone were to say to me, quote, "This morning I saw a lady who was wearing a violet dress. It was cut in such and such a fashion, and her shoes had high heels," unquote, and so on, I would like it better than if someone were to come and say, quote, "The human being consists of physical body, ether body, astral body, and I-being," unquote. The first is standing firmly within life, with a developed ether body. The other has knowledge of the ether body, but it is merely intellectual and doesn't mean much. I have to speak drastically so that we can recognize what is most important in a teacher's training. We should learn not to spin thoughts on things, but learn to observe life. We should learn to use such observations in life as matter of fact. We ruin everything, however, by racking our brains over how we might use it. This is why those who wish to describe something from spiritual science should strongly avoid the usual abstract concepts, because this moves away from what really wants to be said. And it is especially true that those who try to understand things in a usual way will tend toward generalities and not sharp definitions. Here is an extreme example. To me, it is unpleasant to say, quote, "A pale man is standing there," unquote. It hurts. On the other hand, the statement begins to breathe with reality if I say, quote, "The man standing there is pale," unquote. In other words, I do not give a description in stiff, ordinary concepts, but describe using the ideas that enclose it. You will find that children have a greater inner understanding of things when they are expressed in relative form instead of in bare nouns qualified by adjectives. Children prefer a gentle way of handling things. When I say to them, quote, "A pale man is standing there," unquote, it's like hitting something with a hammer. But if I say, "The man standing there is pale," it's like a stroking movement of my hand. Children find it easier to adapt to the world if things are presented in this second form rather than by a hitting quality. We must develop a certain fineness of feeling if we wish to become sculptors of language and to place it in the service of the art of education. It also adds to education as an art if we strive to master language so that we can articulate our words clearly when teaching a class, knowing how to emphasize what is important and passing lightly over the insignificant. We place great value on these things, and the teachers' conferences repeatedly draw attention to the qualitative in teaching. If you truly study a class, you notice all sorts of things that can help. For example, suppose you have a class of 28 boys and girls and want to give them something they can make their own, something that will enrich their inner life. It may be a little poem, even a great poem. So you try to teach this poem to the class. Now you will find that if you have them all recite together, even a third or half of the class, each child will speak and be able to say it. But if you test one or two of the students to see if they can say it by themselves, you will find that they cannot. It is not that you have overlooked these two or failed to notice that they were silent. They can say it very well in chorus with the others. The fact is, however, that a group spirit pervades and activates the class, and you can make use of this. So if you really work with the whole class of children as a chorus, at first it seems as if this invokes comprehension more quickly. But one time I had to point out the shadow side of this procedure, and so I will now give you a secret. There are shadow sides in a Waldorf school. Gradually we find our way and discover that handling a class as a chorus and allowing the children to speak together goes quite well, but when this is overdone, if we work only with the class without considering the individuals, the result will be that no individual child will know anything. We must consider the shadow side of all such things and be clear about how far we can go in handling the class as a chorus, for example, and to what extent we need to work with individual children separately. Theories are useless here. To say it is good to treat the class as a chorus or to maintain that things should be done in this or that way never helps, because in the complexities of life, what we should do one way might also, given other conditions, be done another way. The worst that we can do in education, which is art rather than science, is to give abstract directions based on definitions. Education should always consist of this. Teachers are guided in such a way that they enter with understanding into the development of one or another human being, and through the most convincing examples are led to knowledge of the human being. Method follows naturally if we work this way. Consider, for example, methods of teaching to children under 9 or 10 years. It is futile and closed to such young children. At 9 or 10, you can observe this yourselves, they begin to be interested in individuals. You can portray Caesar, Achilles, Hector, Agamemnon, or Alcibiades simply as people, allowing historical context to become only a background. By painting a picture this way, the children will show real interest. It will be obvious that they are eager to know more. They feel an urge to go more into the lives of these historic figures if you describe them in this way. Comprehensive pictures of personalities, complete in themselves, pictures of how a meal looked during one century or another, pictorial descriptions of how people ate before forks were invented, how they generally ate meals in ancient Rome, descriptions of how a Greek walked, aware of each step and legs form. describing how the Hebrew people of the Old Testament walked with no feeling for form, but slouching with their arms hanging loose, invoking feelings for these various and distinct images, is the right approach to teaching history to children of 10 to 12 years old. Now, at this age, we can take another step and move on to historic relationships. Because until now, children are unable to understand concepts such as cause and effect. Only now can historic connections be presented in history, but everything historic be worked out in ways that show a gradual development. Here we come to the concept of growth, or becoming. You could invoke an image of how we are alive now in 1924. Charles the Great lived from 760 to 814. So using 800 as the approximate date, we find he lived 1,120 years ago. We imagine ourselves living in the world as a child growing up, and we can assume that in the course of a century, we would have a son or daughter, father and mother, grandfather, and perhaps even a great-grandfather. In other words, we have maybe three or four generations, one after another, in 100 years. We can demonstrate these generations by having someone stand and represent the son or daughter. The parent will stand behind that person, with hands resting on the shoulders of the one in front. The grandfather will place his hands on the shoulders of the father, and the great-grandfather his hands on the shoulders of the grandfather. If you imagine son, father, and grandfather, one behind the other as people belonging to the present age, and behind them the generations over the course of 10 centuries, you will need 11 times 3 or 4 generations, say 44 generations. So if you were to place 44 people in this way, each with hands on the shoulders of the one in front, the first might be a man of today, and the last would be Charles the Great. Thus you can change temporal relationships in history, which are so difficult to see, into visible spatial relationships. You could also picture it in another way. You have one person speaking to another. The second one turns and speaks a third one behind, who then does the same. And so it goes on until you are back to the time when Peter spoke to Christ. Thus the whole development of the Christian church is shown by a conversation between people standing one behind the other. The whole apostolic succession is revealed visually. Seize every opportunity to use images and tangible objects. This helps children find a way into the real world and to form everything in keeping with reality. It's simply arbitrary to place 3 beans before the children, add another 3, and then yet another 4, and then teach them addition, 3 plus 3 plus 4 equals 10. This is quite arbitrary. But it is completely different if I have an unknown number of beans in a small pile. This is how things are in the real world. When I divide the pile, the children will quickly understand this. I give some to one child, some to another, and another portion to a third child. I divide the pile, first showing them how many beans there are altogether. I begin with the total and go to the parts. The children could count the beans, since it is just a repetitive process, 1, 2, 3, and so on, up to 12. But I divide them into 4 more, and again into another 4. If I begin with the total and proceed to the parts, the children take it in more easily. It accords with reality. The other way is abstract, just putting things together intellectually. It is also more real if I get them to the point where they must answer a question. If I have 12 apples, and someone takes them and returns only 7, how many have I lost? Here we begin with the minuend, then go from the remainder to the subtrahend. We do not subtract, but go from the remainder, or from what remains as the result of a living process, to what has been taken away. Thus our efforts are not always directed toward abstractions. They find an outlet in reality, and being linked to life, they strive after life. This affects the children and makes them bright and lively, whereas teaching arithmetic has a largely deadening effect. The children remain dead and apathetic, and the inevitable result of this is the calculator. The very fact that we have calculators proves how difficult it is to make arithmetic available to perception. But we must not do this alone. We must learn to read from life itself. The end of Lecture 8.